we have, of course, in Christendom, a new pope, St. Francis. Very interesting to listen to the North American media try to figure out which handles they can actually hold on to in this event, which they know, they feel the cultural weight of it, but they don't really know how to grab it and hand it around. So, scandal, well, we're still waiting for scandal to break in a way that's significant enough to be a news story. St. Francis, that's kind of an interesting subtext. Care for the poor sounds like a good idea. And then there's always political efficacy, just to kind of drag this into the public square somehow. The chair, though, despite all of that and its significance, is not meant to represent denominational religion. It's not meant this morning to be a symbol of Catholicism any more than my orange hoodie is meant to be symbolic of Protestantism. But it is meant to be a symbol. And for our purposes this morning, I would like you to regard the chair as representing the trappings of religion. And in particular, since our context is Christian religion, the trappings of Christian religion, broadly. So despite its formality, it doesn't represent Catholicism in any particular way. And I think that's important. Where it's sitting in the room is also important. And that I'm sitting in it, and that I've already said to somebody who said it was in the wrong place that this chair doesn't move for anyone, is important. That's all I'm going to say about the chair. And beyond that, I invite you, regarding the chair, like I hope I invite you regarding other things, to use your imagination. What I want us to do this morning is engage in a topic that is a little more touchy-feely than sometimes. I want us to give some thought to the matter of being ashamed or not ashamed. So, topically, you could say what we're on about this morning is shame. Very powerful emotion. And in the interest of helping us engage that emotion just a little bit, we're going to do a partial version of something I wish we had time to do a full and conversational version of, but just to get us a little bit into the space of this, I want to invite you to begin by thinking about an experience in your past in which you experienced shame. You won't be asked to say anything about this or to make any permanent record that could be found later. It just has to happen in your head. So be specific. From your childhood, think of a specific incident, not a category, okay? And if you have one in mind, I want you to think about the feelings that went with it. I live in a construction project all week. Why would that suddenly change? Because it's Sunday. Think about the feelings that went with that. And about the feelings and thoughts that you had during that experience or incident. And think about the thoughts or feelings that you had afterward as well. Now, with some of those things in mind, I want you to think for a moment about what impulses you had. Which, let me put it in a physical framework, which direction did you want to move? Did you want to move away from that experience? Assuming there were other people involved, perhaps, did you want to move away from those people? Did you want to move toward that experience or those people? Excuse me. Did you want to move against them, which is different than toward them? This is a little trickier, this bit. And we might just plain not have the time to get there, but for some of us it will come easier than for others of us. See if you can recall where the feeling of shame was located in your body. Did it have a place? And if so, where was it? Did it have any other affective characteristics? Did it have a sound or a color or a texture? And the last thing I would invite you to touch on in your remembering of this briefly is, if you have any sense of the ongoing impact of that experience, what influence or impact does it have on you today? And that could be a good influence or a bad one. It could be a positive impact or a negative impact. There's no rule that says it has to be negative. So just, does it have any impact now? And if so, what is that impact? I want you to keep all of that just on the edge of where things are conscious for you while I read this next bit. This is, I said in my email that I was going to read from two blogs this morning, one contemporary and one ancient. This is the contemporary one. I'm ashamed. I am ashamed that we feast while our neighbors go hungry. I'm ashamed of our selective memory. I'm ashamed of the bumper stickers, the t-shirts, the logos, the fog machines, the light shows, the celebrities, and that paralyzing fear of silence we're so bound and determined to avoid that we keep shouting and shouting and shouting at one another till our words are just clanging cymbals echoing off church walls. I am ashamed of the walls. They are built high with circles of barbed wire around the top to keep pests away from our bread and wine and to keep the silence from getting in. I am ashamed of the abuse, the shaming, the cover-ups, the secrets, the millstones being forged in Sunday school classrooms and pastors' offices where people are supposed to be safe. And I'm ashamed of the way I want to watch those millstones drag a few more bodies down to the bottom of the sea. I am ashamed of the violence in our theology, in our words, in myself. I'm ashamed of how we have confused two kingdoms, demanding God's name on Caesar's coins, invoking God's will in our wars, reducing God's words to against or for. We've turned the Bible into a position paper. I am ashamed of our mindless routines. Segregated Sunday mornings, men up front, women in the back, the Romans road and the sinner's prayer, the what were you wearing to make him say, think, do that? The relentless chase after the, in this writer's culture, American dream. I'm ashamed of mission trips that hurt more than help, of hijacked stories and imagined heroics, of our industrial savior complex, and most of all, my own stubborn complicity in the very injustices I decry. There's slavery stitched into the fabric of my clothes, but I've learned to ignore the itch. I am ashamed that the church has become the scariest place to come out instead of the safest, that it routinely shuts out the most vulnerable, the most hurting, the most despised, when those were the people Jesus started with, the people he loved the most. I am ashamed that we are so quick to speak and so slow to listen. I am ashamed by our lack of imagination, ashamed by our hypocrisy, ashamed by the heavy loads we bind up to place on people's backs, ashamed by the logs in our eyes and the stones in our hands. I am ashamed by our failure to love. I am ashamed of the way I judge those I deem judgmental. the way I stumble through my day without prayer, the way I issue praises to heaven in one breath and curse my brothers in the next, the way I talk a big game about loving others and then brush past the woman crying in the airport, the way cynicism seeps into my bones, the way I zone out in front of my wireless glowing mirror in a pathetic effort to avoid confronting it all. Who's the fairest? I am ashamed. And I am sorry. But I am not ashamed of the gospel. I am not ashamed of this scandalous news whispered first by a pregnant Palestinian teenager whose dream for the world shattered the crowd and lifted up the hump. I am not ashamed of the carpenter anointed to restore sight to the blind and set prisoners free, or his ragamuffin band of fishermen and tax collectors and zealots, his friendship with prostitutes, his strange ways and long stories, his challenge to the religious, his radical notion that women are human. I am not ashamed of the good news that we have it backwards. I am not ashamed that we are learning that privileged are the poor, the peacemakers, the merciful, and the suffering. Cursed are the rich, the full, the merciless, the hateful. I am not ashamed that when God strapped on sandals and walked among us, God fed the hungry, wept with the mourning, touched the untouchable, turned water into wine, cracked jokes about religion, obeyed his mom, defended the defenseless, bantered with children, forgave his enemies, and reminded us that the whole point of it all is to love God and love our neighbors well. That's it. I am not ashamed that when God strapped on sandals and walked among us, God rode a donkey instead of a war horse. I'm not ashamed of the good news that we don't have to wait around for the right leader or the right government, because there's a new and better kingdom growing in us and around us, a kingdom that welcomes all to the table. I am not ashamed of the good news that Jesus is Lord and Caesar is not. I am not ashamed of the very good news that when God strapped on sandals and walked among us and endured the very worst this world has to offer, the very ugliest inside of us, God looked upon it all and said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." I am not ashamed of the very good news, first shouted by another unlikely woman in another garden and then echoed through the centuries in every corner of the earth, that Jesus Christ has risen from the dead. Risen indeed, we say, even when we're not quite sure we believe it. I am not ashamed of this great cloud of witnesses kicking up dust ahead of me on the path. They are hermits and homemakers and sinners and saints and pilgrims and poets and mothers and activists and peacemakers and friends. They bind up wounds and stand up to bullies and offer rides and listen well and make meals and let things go and work hard and fail sometimes, but they keep telling this story that sets both the oppressed and the oppressors free, the story that may even save me. I am not ashamed of love. Love casts out fear. Love knits us together. Love conquers all. I am not ashamed of the church. She is a survivor. After all, a work in progress, a stubborn bride-to-be, the gates of hell will not prevail against her, they say, so I guess I better quit hedging my bets. I am not ashamed because there are all these little mustard seeds scattered across our broken, shameful world. Some of them just now swelling and splitting underneath the dark soil. Others breaking through the surface with a garish flash of green. Others meandering toward the sun, desperate for light or rain or some sort of trellis. Others growing slow and steady into tall shade trees with limbs like arms open to the world, welcoming the birds of the air to nest in their branches. I am not ashamed because my roots are deep and the sky is tall and there will always be some place to grow. I am not ashamed because I am not alone. How about that? The blogger is Rachel Held Evans, who has written, among other things, a book on a year of biblical womanhood, which, so help me, every woman should read. It's just, it's insightful and hilarious, and it'll give your brain a twist about how you read your Bible forever. Shame. Shame, by definition, is the powerful feeling of humiliation or distress caused by the consciousness, by being aware of wrong or foolish behavior. Contemporary psychology would argue, at least on some fronts, that it is a very important emotion, partly because it sometimes unnecessarily creates pain in our lives. In contemporary psychological thought, it would be regarded as a very disturbing experience for the individual, not least of all because in the moment of shame, the self experiences a wound from inside, not from outside. When we're talking about shame this morning, the part of our understanding of it that I want us to keep in mind is the idea that shame itself is the feelings and the thoughts that somehow we or something we are associated with is wrong or defective or inadequate or not good enough or not strong enough. And Rachel Held Evans, in her blog, writing about feeling ashamed and not feeling ashamed, is really making a deep commentary about a matter of the heart, this interior sense of rightness and of wrongness, of adequacy or the inadequacy of something, in this case, the gospel. And that got me thinking about experiences that I've had around feeling ashamed of being a Christian. Had several interesting conversations this past couple of weeks around this incident of a church response to anti-bullying legislation here in the province, and I'm not going to take that on in any direct way this morning, but lots of those conversations were with people who said that their experience was that they felt ashamed to be associated by belief with that kind of a positional response. And that was an interesting thing to talk about. In light of what we've read in this blog, it's as if Held Evans is saying there are some expressions of what it means to be a Christian about the thing we call the gospel that I feel shame about, and there are some that I don't. And I think we've probably all had experiences like that. There are times where we just want to duck our heads and hide, or maybe sometimes we feel a little bit more militant, or we're having a triple biorhythm day. You know, we want to stand up and get militant about it instead and say, that's not what I believe. Please don't paint me with that brush. I don't share that. And what that triggers, the kind of feelings that it triggers in us are different for every one of us, right? I mean, personality is part of this, situation is part of this, there's so many different variables. Well, I said I was going to read a contemporary blog and an ancient one. The ancient one is found in Romans 1. I wasn't just sort of being trite or trying to find a relevant way to treat an ancient text as a preaching strategy when I said that it was a blog, although it might have been more accurate to say of Romans 1 that it wasn't written as a blog, given that that term has technology appended to it, but it was written as an open letter. Somebody got a hold of it and posted it, and the whole world's been able to read it ever since. I should also say before I read this text that I am deeply conscious this morning that it is probably the most commonly used text in the New Testament to bash gays. And fair warning to the community, that's not how I read it. Well, more on that later, but just a heads up. All right. So Paul is writing to the church in Rome, Gentile church. He's writing to say, among other things, how much he wants to come and be with them, but how things have kept getting in the way. So I'm going to pick this up at verse 14 of the first chapter. I am obligated, both to Greeks and non-Greeks, both to the wise and the foolish. That's why I'm so eager to preach the gospel also to you who are at Rome. I am not ashamed of the gospel. Because It is the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes, first for the Jew and for the Gentile. For in the gospel, a righteousness from God is revealed, a righteousness that is by faith from first to last, just as it is written, the righteous will live by faith. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. Since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him, but their thinking became futile, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal men and birds and animals and reptiles. I think Eugene Peterson in The Message says, like trinkets you could buy on any store shelf, something of that kind of image. We'll get to that. Therefore, God gave them over in their hearts, or in the sinful desires of their hearts, to sexual impurity for the degrading of their bodies with one another. They exchanged the truth of God for a lie, and worshipped and served created things rather than the Creator, who is forever praised. Amen. We're going to keep going in the text, but you need to mark that, because that's the pivot of what Paul's on about in this text, right there. Because of this, God gave them over to shameful lusts. Even their women exchanged natural relations for unnatural ones. In the same way, the men also abandoned natural relations with women and were inflamed with lust for one another. Men committed indecent acts with other men and received in themselves the due penalty for their perversion. Furthermore, since they did not think it worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God, he gave them over to a depraved mind to do what ought not to be done. They have become filled with every kind of wickedness, evil, greed, and depravity. They are full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, and malice. They are gossips, slanderers, God-haters, insolent, arrogant, and boastful. They invent ways of doing evil. They disobey their parents. They are senseless, faithless, heartless, ruthless. Although they know God's righteous decree that those who do such things deserve death, they not only continue to do these very things, but also approve of those who practice them. I was drawn to this text, naturally enough, by Paul saying, at the onset of it, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. What did he mean by that? Because one of the rules of making sense of the Bible is that it's a bad idea to make it mean something that it didn't. And so, what did he mean? And how much can we approach that? This is, after all, ancient. Might Paul mean, to put it into the language that we've been using this morning, that when it comes to the story he calls the gospel, this sort of long looping story of God coming to his creation to inaugurate something completely new and a world in which the problem of sin is addressed by limitless forgiveness and the problem of death by resurrection, that when it comes to that story, he does not have the feeling of encountering something that is wrong or defective or inadequate or not good enough or not strong enough, that he's not having the experience with the thing he calls the gospel that causes him shame. He is not ashamed of that story. Might he mean that there's something about that story that is so right, that is so well made, that is so adequate, good enough, strong enough, both for the shape of the moment that we're in and whatever the moment to come might bring, that he's not ashamed of it? But that's not the way he encounters it. What if we think of this passage, just for a moment, in terms of its overall shape, what if we think of it as being a bit like Held Evans' blog, but upside down? What if we think of it, instead of starting with I am ashamed and moving to I am not ashamed, what if we think of it as starting with I am not ashamed and moving to I am ashamed? If we do that, this is, at least when I do that, this is what happens. So if we're starting with I'm not ashamed, in Romans,
What is Paul not ashamed of that he's calling the gospel, the good news? Well, he starts by saying that he's an apostle, a spreader, a perpetrator, a liver of a story that is for everyone. Jews first, then the Gentiles. And just in case that doesn't cover off everybody on the planet, the foolish and the wise. Okay, now we're covered. Right? There's only two categories of people to the Jewish imagination, and that's Jews and Gentiles. So, within those, I probably reasonably surmise that there are those subcategories of wise and foolish in both those camps. So the fact that this story is good news for everybody is a thing to not be ashamed of. Paul makes it really clear at the beginning of the story that he's telling to the Romans that he is not ashamed of the rightness, the no wrongness of God. It's an interesting subtext here. We don't have time to get into it. But when Paul writes about this, the righteousness of God, the no wrongness of God, and its relationship to faith, especially in Ephesians, we kind of suffer under this hubristic translation a little bit, especially in that text, where the text kind of gives us in English this feeling that really we are saved by our faith, and it's kind of a pretty bad misreading of, in my opinion, of the original text, which actually says that we are saved not by faith in Christ, as important as that is, but that we are actually saved by the faith of Christ. That it's the faithfulness of God that saves us. Which I love the way Jay set up that idea with Michelangelo's art. That whatever our faith is, it's not insignificant in the story. It's part of what dignifies us with choice. But if we're going to make it into math, it's this reaching of God toward us so faithfully, Jesus toward us so faithfully, and the Spirit toward us so faithfully that is at the heart of the story. There's no shame in that. And Paul says at the beginning of what he has to say to the Romans that he is not ashamed of the generous revelation of God in all the goodness of creation. How generous is it? Generous enough to save, whatever that means. And it can mean many different things. That whatever it is that we need to see about God in order to know God and to acknowledge God, and Paul makes quite a point of it for good reason that he comes to later, to worship God, All that we need to do that is right around us. This is one of the most essential texts, I think, in the whole New Testament about this idea that when God made the world that we inhabit and called it good, that there was a fusing of spirit and stuff, that the good Spirit of God and the good stuff that God makes are knit together right from the beginning of the story in a way that is not unknit by the story. And one of the reasons I feel so strongly about that is because we have somebody like Paul, who is such an important Christian teacher and thinker in the New Testament, saying everything you need to see about God in order to worship God, you can see in what God has made. That just plain flat out wouldn't be true if it were not for that fusion of spirit and stuff. He's not ashamed of that generous revelation of God and creation. The fact that the generous revelation of God and creation is so efficacious, it's so good enough, strong enough, adequate enough, right enough, to put it into the framework of that shame definition, the fact that that is so in this text is the pivot of the text. And the reason for that is that the people that Paul is writing to and about know God, but they have chosen not to acknowledge that. And that is the heart of this kind of rebellion against harmony and hierarchy that we've been talking about these few weeks, this, about which I've used the phrase, you're in my seat, about our relationship with God. This is the moment in this story where Paul says, when we say to God, I will not live under this hierarchy of the cosmos that has you at the top. I will not worship you, even though I'm surrounded by the evidence that this would be the right response, that this is the response that would help me to live in the part of the created order that I am meant to live in and thrive in, and from the position from which I'm meant to be a co-creator with you. I don't want to be in that position. I actually want to be on the top of the stack. That is the essential problem. That, Paul says, is the attitudinal and action stance that actually opens into the thing that he calls futility, folly, and darkness. to be surrounded by evidence of the existence of God, of the goodness of God, and yet to choose to worship what is lesser in the place of God, that's what Paul is contending opens the door to darkness. I'm intrigued by Eugene Peterson's paraphrase of this moment in the story. Listen to this. So this is verse 18 to 25 of the same text that we just read. But God's angry displeasure erupts as acts of human mistrust and wrongdoing and lying accumulate, as people try to put a shroud over the truth. But the basic reality of God is plain enough. Open your eyes, and there it is. By taking a long and thoughtful look at what God has created, people have always been able to see what their eyes as such can't see. Eternal power, for instance, and the mystery of God's divine being. So nobody has a good excuse. What happened was this. People knew God perfectly, but when they didn't treat him like God, refusing to worship him, they trivialized themselves into silliness and confusion so that there was neither sense nor direction left in their lives. They pretended to know it all, but were illiterate regarding life. They traded the glory of God, who holds the whole world in his hands, for cheap figurines you can buy at any roadside stand. So God said, in effect, if that's what you want, that's what you get. It wasn't long before they were living in a pig pen smeared with filth, filthy inside and out. All this because they traded the true God for a fake God and worshiped the God they made instead of the God who made them. That's the pivot. That's the hinge that this whole text turns on. If that's what you want, that's what you get. Now, we need to pay attention to the context here, because what Paul goes off about next is directly related to the matter of worship, as in they worship the God they made instead of the God who made them. And what he does next in the text is he chronicles a whole litany of the rituals of worship of everything or anything but God. He just rolls out the whole list. I'm not going to camp out on this morning because it's just way too big. It'll keep bleeding into our conversation. But that, what I just said, is essentially the reason why it's a very, very bad idea, if we actually are serious about the Bible speaking God's truth to us, it's a very, very bad idea to use this passage as a combination of LGBT sexuality. Paul is not, and pretty much no biblical passage that deals with that issue, is not referring to loving, committed relationships, same gender or other gender, because he takes them both on in this text. What he's talking about are rituals of pagan worship. He's talking about temple prostitution. He's talking about using sex as worship. And the brokenness of that in every shape. Now, even if you don't accept that reading, and lots of people don't, it's not a gay reading of the text. It actually has very strong scholarly support from across the board in terms of theologians. But even if we don't accept that, I think it's important that we take good care, because whatever Paul's commentary on sexuality is in this text, he doesn't actually give that commentary any more weight than he gives to envy, gossip, malice, insolence, arrogance, and disobeying your parents. So, in for a penny, in for a pound, right? Could it be, and I'll kind of leave us with this, could it be that the same story that unashamedly says everybody included is equally ready to give freedom for choosing our own pathway when it comes to who's at the top of the hierarchy of what we worship? Could it be that the same story that teaches us that the world is good, that the world is filled with evidence of the goodness that God is, even while we kind of stumble through this season where that goodness is sometimes made murky by the darkness of suffering, could it be that that same story teaches us we have the freedom to choose whether we will live in the story in ways that put God on the top of the stack or ways that don't? And could it be that when it comes to being ashamed or not ashamed, we can, to no small degree, have what we want? Could this be the nature of the world in which we live? that we are free to choose in all these realms, from the way that we look at and treat the world around us, to the way that we worship, to the values and practices that we reflect in our relational choices, including our sexuality, and that we are free to live with the consequences of what we choose. And could it be that those choices are directly related to whether we walk through the world day by day, ashamed or unashamed? I'm not posing those ideas as questions as a rhetorical device. I'm posing those ideas as questions because, to me, the answers, in many ways, are outstanding. They are questions that we are here to work on. There are work to do. And it's a work in progress, not a fait accompli. But I think, to the degree that those questions have merit, they leave us with a fairly succinct, personal question, which is the question, what do I want? And what I'd like us to do, while Tim and Jane and Atticus get ready to come and sing for us, lead us in that part of our worship together, is I want us to take a few moments of silence and consider the question as a prayer, what do I want?